Chapter 35. We are now on a willow islet amidst the quietest branch of the Blue Lador, with wet fields on one side and on the other a view of Bryant's Castle, remote and romantically black on its oak-timbered hill. In that oval seclusion, Van subjected his new Ada to a comparative study. Juxtapositions were easy, since the child he had known in minute detail 4 years before stood vividly illumined in his mind against the same backdrop of flowing blue. Her forehead area seemed to have diminished, not only because she had become taller, but because she did her hair differently, with a dramatic swirl in front. Its whiteness, now clear of all blemishes, had acquired a particularly matte tinge, and soft skin folds crossed it as if she had been frowning too much all those years, poor Ada. The eyebrows were as regal and thick as ever. The eyes. The eyes had kept their voluptuous, palpable creases, the lashes, their semblance of jet dust incrustation, the raised iris, its Hindu hypnotic position, the lids, their inability to stay alert and wide open during the briefest embrace. But those eyes' expression, when she ate an apple, or examined a found thing, or simply listened to an animal or a person, had changed, as if new layers of reticence and sadness had accumulated, half veiling the pupil, while the glossy eyeballs shifted in their lovely long sockets with a more restless motion than of yore. Mademoiselle Hypnokush, whose eyes never dwell on you and yet pierce you. Her nose had not followed Van's in the latter's thickening of Hibernian outline, but the bone was definitely bolder, and the tip seemed to turn up more strongly, and had a little vertical groove that he did not recall having seen in the 12-year-old Collinette. In a strong light, a suggestion of darkish silk down, related to that on her forearms, could now be made out between nose and mouth, but was doomed, she said, to extinction at the first cosmetical session of the fall season. A touch of lipstick now gave her mouth an air of deadpan sullenness, which, by contrast, increased the shock of beauty, when in gaiety or greed she revealed the moist shine of her large teeth and the red riches of tongue and palate. Her neck had been and remained his most delicate, most poignant delight, especially when she let her hair flow freely, and the warm, white, adorable skin showed through in chance separations of glossy black strands. Boils and mosquito bites had stopped pestering her, but he discovered the pale trace of an inch-long cut which ran parallel to her vertebrae just below the waist, and which resulted from a deep scratch caused last August by an erratic hatpin, or rather by a thorny twig in the inviting hay. "You are merciless, Van." On that secret islet, forbidden to Sunday couples, it belonged to the Veens, and a notice board calmly proclaimed that trespassers might get shot by sportsmen from Ardis Hall, Dan's wording. The vegetation consisted of three Babylonian willows, a fringe of alder, many grasses, cattails, sweet flags, and a few purple-lipped tway blades over which Ada crooned as she did over puppies or kittens. Under the shelter of those neurotic willows, Van pursued his survey. Her shoulders were intolerably graceful. I would never permit my wife to wear strapless gowns with such shoulders, but how could she be my wife? Rennie says to Nell in the English version of Montparnasse's rather comic tale, "The infamous shadow of our unnatural affair will follow us into the lower depths of the inferno, which our Father, who is in the sky, shows to us with his superb digit." For some odd reason, the worst translations are not from the Chinese, but from plain French. Her nipples, now pert and red, were encircled by fine black hairs, which would soon go too, being, she said, unschicklich. Where had she picked up, he wondered, that hideous word? Her breasts were pretty, pale and plump, but somehow he had preferred the little soft swellings of the earlier girl with their formless, dull buds. He recognized the familiar, individual, beautiful intake of her flat young abdomen, its wonderful play, the frank and eager expression of the oblique muscles and the smile of her navel, to borrow from the vocabulary of the belly dancer's art. One day he brought his shaving kit along and helped her to get rid of all three patches of body hair. "Now I'm Sheher," he said, "and you are Hizada, and that's your green prayer carpet." Their visits to that islet remained engraved in the memory of that summer with entwinements that no longer could be untangled. They saw themselves standing there, embraced, clothed only in mobile leafy shadows, and watching the red rowboat with its mobile inlay of reflected ripples carry them off, waving their handkerchiefs. And that mystery of mixed sequences was enhanced by such things as the boats floating back to them while it still receded, the oars crippled by refraction, the sunflex now rippling the other way like the strobe effects of spokes counterwheeling as the pageant rolls by. Time tricked them, made one of them ask a remembered question, caused the other to give a forgotten answer, and once, in a small alder thicket, duplicated in black by the blue stream, they found a garter, which was certainly hers. She could not deny it, but which Vaughn was positive she had never worn on her stockingless summer trips to the Magic Islet. Her lovely strong legs had, maybe, grown longer, but they still preserved the sleek pallor and suppleness of her nymphet years. She could still suck her big toe. The right instep and the back of her left hand bore the same small, not over-conspicuous, but indelible and sacred birthmark, which, with nature, had signed his right hand and left foot. She attempted to coat her fingernails with Scheherazade's lacquer, a very grotesque fad of the 80s, but she was untidy and forgetful in matters of grooming. The varnish flaked off, leaving unseemly blotches, and he requested her to revert to her lackluster state. In compensation, he bought her in the town of Lador, that rather smart little resort, an ankle chain of gold. But she lost it in the course of their strenuous trysts and unexpectedly broke into tears when he said, never mind, another lover someday would retrieve it for her. Her brilliance. Her genius. Of course, she had changed in 4 years, but he too had changed, by concurrent stages, so that their brains and senses stayed attuned and were to stay thus always, through all separations. Neither had remained the brash Wunderkind of 1884, but in bookish knowledge both surpassed their coevals to an even more extent than in childhood, and in formal terms, Ada, born on July 21, 1872, had already completed her private school course, while Vaughn, her senior by 2 years and a half, hoped to get his master's degree at the end of 1889. Her conversation might have lost some of its sportive glitter, and the first faint shadows of what she would later term my Acarpus destiny, Pustot Svetniest, could be made out, at least, in back view. But the quality of her innate wit had deepened. Strange metempirical, as Vaughn called them, undercurrents seemed to double internally, and thus enrich the simplest expression of her simplest thoughts. She read as voraciously and indiscriminately as he, but each had evolved a more or less pet subject. He the terological part of psychiatry, she the drama, especially Russian. A pet he found, Pat, in her case, but hoped would be a passing vagary. Her floromania endured, alas, but after Dr. Krolik died, in 1886, of a heart attack in his garden, she had placed all her live pupae in his open coffin where he lay, she said, as plump and pink as in vivo. Amorously now, in her otherwise dolorous and irresolute adolescence, Ada was even more aggressive and responsive than in her abnormally passionate childhood. A diligent student of case histories, Dr. Van Veen never quite managed to match ardent 12-year-old Ada with a non-delinquent, non-nymphomaniac, mentally highly developed, spiritually happy and normal English child in his files, although many similar little girls had bloomed and run to seed in the old chateau of France and Estotiland, as portrayed in extravagant romances and senile memoirs. His own passion for her, Vaughn found even harder to study and analyze. when he recollected caress by caress his Venus Villa sessions, or earlier visits to the river houses of Ranta or Livida, he satisfied himself that his reactions to Ada remained beyond all that, since the merest touch of her finger or mouth following a swollen vein produced not only a more potent, but essentially different delicia than the slowest Winslow of the most sophisticated young harlot. What, then, was it that raised the animal act to a level higher than even that of the most exact arts or the wildest flights of pure science? It would not be sufficient to say that in his lovemaking with Ada, he discovered the pang, the ogyon, the agony of supreme reality. Reality, better say, lost the quotes it wore like claws, in a world where independent and original minds must cling to things or pull things apart in order to ward off madness or death, which is the master madness. For one spasm or two he was safe. The new naked reality needed no tentacle or anchor. It lasted a moment, but could be repeated as often as he and she were physically able to make love. The color and fire of that instant reality depended solely on Ada's identity as perceived by him. It had nothing to do with virtue or the vanity of virtue in a large sense. In fact, it seemed to Vaughn later that during the ardencies of that summer, he knew all along that she had been and still was atrociously untrue to him, just as she knew long before he told her that he had used off and on during their separation the live mechanisms tense males could rent for a few minutes as described with profuse woodcuts and photographs in a 3-volume History of Prostitution, which she had read at the age of 10 or 11 between Hamlet and Captain Grant's Micro-Galaxies. For the sake of the scholars who will read this forbidden memoir with a secret tingle, they are human, in the secret chasms of libraries, where the chatter, the lays, and the fannies of rotting pornographers are piously kept. Its author must add, in the margin of galley proofs which a bedridden old man heroically corrects, for those slippery long snakes add the last touch to a writer's woes, a few more. The end of the sentence cannot be deciphered, but fortunately, the next paragraph is scrawled on a separate writing pad page. Editor's note. About the rapture of her identity. The asses who might really think that in the starlight of eternity, my, Von Veen's, and her, Ada Veen's, conjunction, somewhere in North America in the 19th century, represented but 1/1,000,000,000th of a trillionth part of a pinpoint planet's significance, can bray ayur, ayur, ayur. The English word would not supply the onomatopoeic element. Old Veen is kind. Because the rapture of her identity, placed under the microscope of reality, which is the only reality, shows a complex system of those subtle bridges which the senses traverse, laughing, embraced, throwing flowers in the air, between membrane and brain, and which always was and is a form of memory, even at the moment of its perception. I am weak. I write badly. I may die tonight. My magic carpet no longer skims over crown canopies and gaping nestlings and her rarest orchids. Insert.